very much. Good song leading tonight. I'm really glad that you're here tonight. I think it's going to be a blessing. I know it's going to be a blessing to you, and I know it's going to be a blessing to you because we're going to look at Matthew chapter 9 tonight. If you've got your Bible, you might open there, Matthew chapter 9 tonight. And we're going to walk through Matthew chapter 9 and hear the message that Matthew himself, that God himself through Matthew is preaching to us. There's a lot of different stories that are related. There's a lot of events that are being related here. And I think there's benefit maybe in looking at each of them individually. But there is a theme that Matthew is presenting that weaves all of these together. And I think there is a powerful point, especially at the end when the conclusion's drawn. And that's what I want you to see tonight. I want you to hear what Matthew is preaching. And so take your Bible and open to the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 9. That's where we're going to study from tonight, Matthew chapter 9. And in preparation to do that, I want to ask you a question, or I want to think about a question with you as we get started. We're going to talk about compassion, of course. But when we think about compassion, of course, Jesus would be associated with compassion. Jesus is a man of compassion. We could go, I know that you would agree with that, right? Everyone here tonight, we would all agree. When we think about Jesus, we think about somebody that's merciful. We think about somebody that's compassionate. We think about somebody that's loving. And Jesus truly is. And if we go out here, even into just the community around, and we ask people that maybe people that don't just regularly go to church, maybe they're people that don't even believe in Jesus, but what they understand about Jesus, just the popular understanding of who Jesus is he's a man of compassion. So even non-church-going people believe that Jesus, see Jesus as a compassionate person. But I want to follow up with something. When we think of church people, when we think about his disciples, the people who call themselves after his name, Christians, what do worldly people think of Christians? Is compassion one of the attributes that worldly people, non-church-going people, is compassion, mercy, and love one of the things, one of the ways, one of the associations that they would make with Jesus' disciples? What about church-going people? If you ask church-going people, what do you think of other Christians? Is compassion, mercy, and love attributes that we would associate with? You don't have to name anybody. You don't have to acknowledge it even out loud. You just think about that. Is mercy, compassion, and love something that we associate with church people, with other Christians, with Jesus' disciples? I think we would admit that sometimes, not always and not everyone, but sometimes the most hurtful people are church people. It shouldn't be that way. It ought not to be that way. But sometimes religious people are not very compassionate, not very merciful, and not very loving. I think this chapter, Matthew chapter 9, addresses that, and it's something that we really need to think about. So look at Matthew chapter 9 and notice that there are three times this concept of mercy or compassion is repeated. So Matthew chapter 9 and verse 13, Jesus is quoting here from the book of Hosea, Matthew chapter 9 and verse 13, "But go then and learn what this means. I desire compassion." I'm reading out of the New American Standard, by the way, in case it's translated slightly different than yours. "I desire compassion and not sacrifice." And then if you skip down to verse 27, two blind men cry out to Jesus and they say to him, "Have mercy on us, son of David." And then at the very end of the chapter, when Jesus is speaking with the Pharisees in verse 36, it says that Jesus, seeing the people, has compassion or feels compassion for them. So three times in this chapter, this theme of mercy or compassion is repeated. I think Matthew's trying to tell us something. I think he's keying in on this word. It's something that is highlighted for us. He repeats it, so that it stands out for us. He's telling us something about it. And so we need to slow down. We need to think about what is it that he's asking us to consider. What is the message that he has in mind here? So notice the stories that are related for us. Jesus calls Matthew. He calls Levi the tax collector. Matthew, Levi, is his given name. But Matthew, that's the name that we know him by. Jesus calls Matthew. And so let's read together Matthew chapter 9 and verse 9. Let's just walk through these stories together and see what Matthew's doing with them. As Jesus went out from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. And he called him, or he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. Then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. So the first story that we have here for us, at least the ones that we're going to read tonight, is Jesus calls Matthew. Matthew's the tax collector. And of course, if you know anything about tax collectors, even in our modern day, you know, we paid taxes. What is tomorrow's tax day, right? Now, some of you may have your taxes taken out week by week, and so you maybe don't think about it. I get to write checks and send them in periodically. They're kind of meaningful that way when you have to sign them over. They're not my buddies. They're not my friends. And you know what? Even worse in the first century, here are people that are considered not only thieves, but traitors to their own people. They're not loved by the Romans, and they're hated by their own people. Friendless for sure, and so they stick together. That's why all the tax collectors are eating together. They're hated as traitors and as thieves. And that's who Jesus calls. And then I want you to notice what's said here. Matthew was seated actively doing the despised work. That's the way that it's presented here, right? He's seated. When Jesus calls him, when Jesus speaks to him and says, "Come follow me," Matthew is seated. He is doing this work that in that very moment. He's engaged in it. And I wonder how many good and upright and respectable Jewish people saw Jesus as they were paying their taxes to this thieving, hated traitor. How many of these good, upright, righteous Jewish people saw Jesus and heard him call Matthew to be a disciple? I want you to notice the next thing that you see. Matthew followed him. Matthew follows him, right? "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. I know there's not a lot that's said there, but there is a lot that is said there. He got up and followed him. Now, I know for many people, there's a misunderstanding, especially, you know, we hear this in our day and age. We hear this. There's a misunderstanding of tolerance and compassion. We hear this message about tolerance, that we need to tolerate. We need to be tolerant. And really what's being advocated is acceptance. So I need to accept whatever somebody else is doing. And maybe even more than accept, I need to congratulate. I need to praise. I need to support. I need to encourage. Jesus is not encouraging thievery. Jesus is not encouraging traitors. Jesus is not encouraging that in his compassion. There's a misunderstanding I think a lot of us have with compassion and tolerance. We need to be careful about that. It does not mean that we never tell somebody that what they're doing is wrong or what they're doing is sinful or what they're doing is going to lead them to destruction. Being compassionate does not keep us from warning people about danger. Maybe that's partly why people have a bad attitude towards Christians. Could be that they see us as uncompassionate because we do warn people about the wrong that they do. No, I think compassion is just the idea of not rubbing somebody's nose in their past mistakes, right? If it's in my past, I want it to be left in my past. I'm trying to leave it in my past, and I don't need anybody else reminding me all the time. I'm thinking especially of a particular individual right now. And I told them that the place that they were moving back to their home area, and I told them that that was the best place for them because they'd have a lot of support around them because they've got family, but it'd be also the worst place for them because they're going to be around all their family. Because you can never escape who you once were. Doesn't matter how you've changed, it doesn't matter who you are now, you're never going to be, in the eyes of some people, you're never going to be anything other than what you once were. Compassion, mercy, tolerance. It's not rubbing somebody else's nose in their past mistakes. And so for Matthew, whatever Matthew was, I don't know that he was a thief. But whatever he was, even if he was a thief, when he was called by Jesus, he left it all behind and followed Jesus. I think that that's a really important point. Whatever he was, as vile and wicked as Matthew might have been, when Jesus called him, he left it behind and followed Jesus. And so now Jesus teaches us a lesson on compassion. And so let's read on a little bit further. Matthew chapter 9, picking up where we left off, verse 11. When the Pharisees saw this, Jesus eating with the tax collectors and sinners, when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners?" But when Jesus heard this, he said, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick." Why are you among sick people? Because I'm a doctor for sick people. I'm in the right place. That's what Jesus is saying. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, this passage is taken from the book of Hosea. I forgot to get my Old Testament out. It's taken from the book of Hosea, Hosea chapter 6. And I want you to think about something as you turn there to Hosea chapter 6. Think about the message that Hosea is preaching. You might remember, if you studied through Hosea before, it's one of the longer minor prophets, one of the longer short prophets. But it's really still not very long. God has a purpose for Hosea. He's going to use Hosea. God actually does this with several of his prophets. He does this with Jeremiah. God tells Jeremiah he is not allowed to get married. And it is to demonstrate something about the relationship that God has with his people, Israel. Ezekiel is told that when his wife dies, that he is not to mourn for her. Well, Hosea has a situation like this. Hosea is told to go and marry. And you might remember, if you studied through this before, that he is told to go and take, the King James says, a wife of harlotry, of whoredom. And I know sometimes we might discuss this in Bible classes. I don't think that he is telling Hosea to go and marry someone who is actively engaged in that kind of behavior when he marries her. I think what God is telling Hosea to do is, I want you to go, don't go get yourself a good church girl, go out and just find a girl of her age, a girl of her society, a girl of her culture. I think that that's what's being communicated. And as Hosea marries her, she begins to cheat on Hosea, and they have several children, and by the name of the last child, Hosea is not even confident that this is his child. That's the scenario. That's the situation. And it's all to reflect this relationship that God has with his rebellious and adulterous people, Israel. I want you to read what's said here at the beginning of chapter 6. Hosea chapter 6 and verse 1. "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, and he will heal us. He has wounded us, and he will bind up our wounds. He will revive us after 2 days, and on the third day he will raise us up so we can live in his presence. Let us strive to know the Lord. His appearance is as sure as the dawn. He will come to us like rain, like spring rain shower, or like spring showers that water the land." Now, When you hear that, remember God is going to punish Israel. He's punishing them because of their adulterous ways, because of their constant rebellion. And now here they are, they're making these overtures. What do you think about what they're saying? Does it sound right? Will not God revive us after 2 days? Will He not bandage us up? Will He not lift us up? If we return to the Lord, will He not bandage our wounds? Because God is faithful, just as sure as the spring rains, God is faithful. If we return to the Lord will revive us. All of that's true, right? Notice verse 4, God's response to what the people have just said. What am I to do with you, Ephraim? What am I going to do with you, Judah? Your love is like a morning mist and like the early dew that vanishes. This is why I have used the prophets to cut them down. I've killed them with the words of my mouth. My judgment strikes like lightning. For I desire faithful love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. I think what's happening here, because it's really different, what God responds with doesn't seem to follow what the people have just said. And I think the reason for it is when we read the first three verses and we hear the people of Israel speaking, we think that they're telling us the truth. We think that they mean it. They mouth the right words. God, we're sorry. We're sorry, Lord. We know that You're faithful and we know that You love us. We're coming back, God. Don't be mad anymore. They mouth the right words, but they don't mean it. Have you ever had somebody tell you that they're sorry? And you just know the look in their eye, the tone of their voice, you just know they do not mean the words that's coming out of their mouth. That's why God says in verse 4, what am I going to do with you? The very people that want God's compassion, the very people that need God's compassion, in Matthew chapter 9, the Pharisees who are condemning Jesus, the physician going and helping sick people, the very people that need Jesus are the ones who have no compassion for anyone else. Read on, Matthew chapter 9. So Jesus illustrates the point. Verse 14. Then the disciples of John came to Him asking. Notice that it seems like this is a whole different scenario, right? Jesus calls Matthew and then He's eating with Matthew. And then all of a sudden we have this issue with John's disciples. Seems like these are different stories, but there's a theme that runs through this. Then the disciples of John came to Him saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? Jesus said to them, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, then they will fast. But no one puts a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment and a worse tear results. Nor do people put new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the wineskins burst and the wine pours out and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into fresh wineskins and both are preserved. And so there's an illustration of the point that Jesus is making. What is an appropriate patch for an old garment? My house, like every house that has children, there are knees that wear out in blue jeans. Everybody that has kids knows that the knees wear out before anything else does. So in our house, the older blue jeans that can't be patched anymore, the older blue jeans, they become the patches for the newer blue jeans. So we've got stacks of old denim to patch up other old denim. What is an appropriate patch for an old pair of jeans? An old pair of jeans. Jesus is asking, what is the appropriate container for new wine? What is the appropriate attitude toward the weak, toward the broken, and toward the sinful? What is the appropriate attitude towards them? We have somebody that's broken. We have somebody that is lost. We have a sinner among us. What is the appropriate attitude? To beat them down until they know how bad they are? They know how bad they are. Now, I'm not talking about people that are still out in the world in defiant rebellion to God. There's a different response for them. But we're dealing with people who have come to Jesus. I will follow you, Jesus. Matthew is following Jesus. Whatever he was, that's not who he wants to be now. What is the appropriate response for somebody that knows that they're broken, they know that they're lost, and they know they need Jesus? What is the appropriate response to that person? To beat them down until they are sure that they are lost? What is the appropriate attitude for the weak and the broken and the sinful? And so now, as we read on through Matthew gives us a couple different examples of compassion. And so let's read about the synagogue official. I think that this is just, the comparison here is brilliant. So read on. This is Matthew chapter 9. Now it gets broken up because the woman with the hemorrhage kind of falls in between. But I just want to read the story here of the synagogue official. Matthew chapter 9 and verse 19. Or I'm sorry, 18 and 19. And while he was saying these things to them, a synagogue official came and bowed down before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hands on her and she will live." And Jesus got up and began to follow him, and so did his disciples. And then he's interrupted, but skip on down to verse 23. When Jesus came into the official's house and saw the flute players and the crowd in noisy disarray, he said, "Leave, for the girl has not died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him. But when the crowd had been sent out, he entered and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. And the news spread throughout all the land. Now, here's why I think this is so important. Because this synagogue official is the very same kind of people. I don't know if he was one of them in particular, but those kind of people are the very kind of people who were just criticizing Jesus for eating with Matthew and his friends. And why were those people, the Pharisees, criticizing Jesus for eating with Matthew and the tax collectors? Because we know those kind of people, I don't know that one individually, but those kind of people are all thieves and traitors. How dare you eat with those kind of people? And now we have somebody just like the ones who'd criticized Jesus, in desperate need of Jesus' help. You've heard things like that, right? I don't know the person individually, but that kind of person, those kind of people. And we categorize people in all kinds of different ways, right? The way that they look and where they're from and how they speak. Those kind of people. You don't want anything to do with those kind of people. That's what the Pharisees were doing about Matthew and his friends. And now, one of those same kind of people, this synagogue official, now he needs help. Now, if Jesus had behaved just like the Pharisees, what would he have said? "I didn't want my help before. Why do you think I'd help you now?" Now, of course, maybe just a couple things to note. Luke tells us that the girl had not died, but that girl was dying. Sometimes people take this and see this as a discrepancy between Luke and Matthew, as though there's some sort of contradiction. Luke tells us the state of the girl. The girl was dying. She had not died when her father met Jesus. Matthew does not tell us the state of the girl's health. Matthew tells us what the dad thinks about his daughter. He comes to Jesus and he says, "My daughter's dead." You can imagine if she's sick and he is desperate enough to come and talk to Jesus. I don't know if he trusted Jesus, believed in Jesus, or if it was a means of last resort. I don't know. But here he is and he comes to Jesus, and you can imagine he's all out of sorts. And so he's saying all kinds of things. "She's probably dead already. Please just come with me. I don't know what's going on with her, but she's probably dead already. Just please and come." Can you hear any pain or fear or desperation in his words? "My daughter, my baby girl, she's probably dead already." And so what is the appropriate response to this man? Not these kind of men, but that man. When he stands before you and he's broken and he's lost and he's desperate, what is the appropriate response? All right, let's talk about the hemorrhaging woman for just a moment. So back up in Matthew chapter 9, this time verse 20. As Jesus is going to Jairus' house, Matthew chapter 9 and verse 20, and a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years. For 12 years, can you imagine? It's interesting. Mark tells us that the girl that Jesus raises was 12. This woman has a hemorrhage for 12 years. I think there's an important point that's being made there as well. But a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years, not only is she in a weakened state, but she's unclean. She's unclean. She's been unclean for 12 years. How isolating would this be? How embarrassing would this be? "Came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak, for she was saying to herself, 'If I only touch his garment, I will get well.' But Jesus, turning and seeing her, said, 'Daughter, take courage, your faith has made you well.' At once the woman was made well." Now, how weak must she have been? Absolutely. And I know that there are a lot of people that suffer with private hurts and certainly this woman had. But did you catch what Jesus calls her? Now, I don't know how old she is. Obviously, she's more than 12, right? Maybe she's in her mid-20s. I don't know. Maybe she's in her mid-60s. I don't know how old she is, but what does Jesus call her? You see it? Verse 22. "Daughter." Now, we just read about a man who is desperate to do anything he can to help his daughter, his baby girl. I remember giving this lesson in a particular place, and a dad came up. We were talking. Matter of fact, it was before I even gave this lesson. He and I were talking, and he has a couple girls. And we were talking about one of them in particular. He just says to me, "There's not anything I wouldn't do for her." And I don't think he was just saying that as, you know, "I would do anything for my daughter." I think he's meaning that I would do bad things to protect my daughter. I have daughters. I was sharing this with somebody even this morning. When one of my daughters was 16 years old, even when she was 16 years old, she would get up in my lap in the evening with her blanket and let me rock her. I don't know that I'd be physically able to, but I hope when she's 60 years old, I'd hope that I'd be able to still rock my baby girl. Dads see that with their girls, with their babies. What does Jesus call this woman? Perhaps ostracized from society. She's unclean. I've been unclean for 12 years. How lonely that must be. But she's somebody's girl. She matters to Jesus. Read on, Matthew chapter 9, verse 27 now. Jesus meets, now he's going to interact with some men. He meets two blind men. Jesus went on from there. Two blind men followed him, crying out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." And when he entered the house, the blind men came up to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" And they said, "Yes, Lord." And he touched their eyes, saying, "It shall be done to you according to your faith." Why does he touch their eyes? So they know that Jesus is there with them, right? It's to connect with them. So he touches their eyes. And their eyes were opened, verse 30, and Jesus sternly warned them, "See that no one knows about this," but they went out and spread the news about him throughout the land. I don't know that it was disobedience. It's how could they not tell it? How could they help but tell it? But you have these two blind men. And remember, you know this from the book of John. Remember when Jesus heals a man that was born blind? And the disciples, even Jesus' own disciples, ask, "Who sinned? This man who was born this way, or his parents, that he should be born blind?" Something bad has happened, and therefore somebody must have done something bad for him to deserve it. So here you have two men, and what does society say about these two men? These must be bad guys because bad things have happened to them. What's the appropriate response? So Jesus reaches out to these perceived wicked people. And then, if we've missed the point, if we've really missed the point of what's going on, who does Jesus interact with next? Go ahead, look at it. Who does he interact with next? So you have a desperate father pleading for his dead daughter. You have this woman who has been weakened over years and years of this hemorrhage. You have men that are perceived to be seen as wicked because they cannot see. And finally, if we've missed the point, Jesus interacts with somebody who is literally caught by the devil, right? Matthew chapter 9, the demon-possessed man, verse 32 and 33. "And as they were going out, a mute, demon-possessed man was brought to him. And after the demon was cast out, the mute man spoke. And the crowds were amazed and were saying, 'Nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel.'" Matthew really spells it out for us here. Here's a person that's literally caught by the devil. And so you have Jesus showing mercy on the dying and the weak and the blind and even those who are in fact caught by the devil. Jesus has compassion for all of them, and then the chapter ends. Right? Look at Matthew chapter 9. What's the last thing that happens? Let's read this together. Verse 34. The crowds are saying, "Nothing like this has ever been seen in the land." But the Pharisees, the religious people, the good church-going folk, were saying, "He casts out demons by the ruler of the demons." I don't know that they even believe that. It's just, we got to do something about this guy. We have got to answer it. We've got to say something. I don't think that they really mean this. I don't think that they really believe it. I think they just say something to get the crowds under control. Verse 35. Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. And seeing the people, he felt compassion for them. Why? Why? Because they were distressed and dispirited. They were downcast and oppressed, like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore beseech the Lord of harvest to send out workers into the harvest." Notice that right after Jesus, he cares for the dying, he cares for the weak. He cares for those that are dead, those that are weak. He cares for those that are perceived to be wicked. He cares for those that are literally caught by the devil. And in response to that, the good church-going folks say, "That's a work of the devil. Compassion, mercy, and love is a work of the devil." It's an inappropriate response. And so Jesus laments the spiritual leadership of the people. How can you not? The people don't even know what they need. They don't even know that they're weak and they're broken and they're lost. They're sheep without a shepherd. They don't even know what they're doing. And Jesus laments the fact that they're so lost, because the people that ought to be guiding them view anything such as compassion as evil. And so please, God, I think we could join in Jesus' words here and plead, please, God, send out workers. Send out workers that have a heart like you have. Send out workers that have compassion and mercy and love for those that are hurting and the broken and lost. Why are there so few? The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Why is it so few? Let me ask another question. Do you want hired hands, or do you want shepherds? Jesus makes the contrast, right? When he talks about himself being the good shepherd, and then he talks about other shepherds, but he calls them hirelings. They're the hired hands, right? These sheep don't belong to them. They're just paid to do a service. Which kind do you want? Do you want people who genuinely care for you? I'm partial to my children. I love my children. Even when they misbehave, I love my children. They don't misbehave anymore, they're grown-ups. When they were little, they might misbehave a little bit. I love my children. Other people's children, I can tolerate. Who do you want, hired hands or shepherds? See, the world is still filled with the distressed and the downcast. And so if we're going to go out and we're going to share the message of Jesus with these lost and broken people, let's make sure that we share it with compassion. I hope that you found that encouraging. We want to be people of compassion. We want to be people modeled in the image of Jesus. There's a lot of hurting people in this world. And not all of them are staunch in their rebellion. There are people that are looking for healing. And for those people, let's have compassion. If there's someone here tonight that's broken and that's hurting, that's needing Jesus, we want to be compassionate to you. And we want to help you in every way that we can. If you need to put Jesus Christ on in baptism, we want to do that with you. If you need prayers or the encouragement of the disciples that are in this place, let's pray together tonight. Come while we stand and sing. Bring Christ you.